To be honest, before I found Unitarian Universalism, I was pretty sure that all religion was patriarchal and sexist. Finding this faith nearly 20 years ago, however, I discovered a new hope and a new vision. A church where women's lives, voices, and stories were valued and respected equally. Where bodies weren't scorned, but also valued. And where healthy sexuality was considered integral to healthy spirituality. Even more revolutionary, here was a church that promised to help each other to be their best selves, most of all by seeking and speaking the truth in love, rather than covering it up. Here was a church that promised to practice mutual learning and mutual accountability. A few months after I joined my first Unitarian Universalist church, however, I realized that despite these stated promises or our feminist intentions, and even regardless of our sexuality education that teaches consent and the complicating nature of power starting in kindergarten, we like all religious institutions and all humans, have a shadow side. The things we don't want to talk about or can't talk about, the things that we are not even always able to see. Little by little, the stories of the past minister of my new church started to emerge. He had assaulted women in the church under the guise of pastoral care. Families had been torn apart in the name of free love. I wasn't too dismayed, however, by the news of the misconduct itself. Unitarian Universalism had never promised to be anything other than a human institution filled with humans. What gave me pause was the response. First, the length of time that the misconduct continued, 3 decades, without any direct response from leaders or the church as a whole. And more disturbingly, many years after he'd left, there appeared to still be no shared understanding of the damage that his behavior had caused. No open conversation, no speaking the truth in love about power or religious authority, no apparent attempt to restore the broken covenant. Instead, there was this sense like, well, we dealt with that. Let's just move on. But clearly, they hadn't. Since then, I've learned that my first Unitarian Universalist congregation story was far from unique. The Reverend Deborah Pope Lance, who is considered our faith's foremost expert in sexual misconduct, she estimates that nearly 70% of our congregations have a history of misconduct or abuse by their ministers. That's our congregations, Unitarian Universalist congregations. And in a recent phone call, she confessed she was starting to believe that the prevalence was actually much higher. Because the stories are still surfacing. After decades of shame and pain and flat-out cover-up. Last month, in a gathering with other Unitarian Universalist ministers, when we talked about the Me Too movement and the way it was playing out in our congregations, one of my colleagues leaned over to me and half whispered, "I wonder how many of our male colleagues are out there right now, worried that their story is the next one to surface." We both took a deep breath, because this is not news. It's family. Me Too always begins here, in our family, in our lives, our stories, in all our struggles and pain, complications and questions, challenges and opportunities. There is no them in me too. It's all us. Nothing brought this home to me more than over the past few weeks as I received some of your, that is, our Me Too stories. They were slow to come in at first, and I worried that maybe we wouldn't have enough. And then spring break ended, and I started to worry about having too many. It's one thing to hear the statistics on the prevalence of sexual violence, or to hear the stories themselves one at a time. It's another to absorb in a few moments the many, many stories of pain, confusion, shame, anger, violence, secrecy, and also resilience, hope, and resistance that are present not somewhere else, but here. Later in the service, we'll have a ritual where we'll share some of the stories up on the screen. And I want to tell you right now that I was right to worry. It is too many. It's way too many. Hearing these stories requires a tolerance for truth-telling and truth-receiving beyond what we usually ask of one another and ourselves in this space. And still, that is what we're asking today, because these are our stories, and this is us. These are our lives that we've often kept hidden in an effort to protect first ourselves, afraid we would be judged or shamed or worse. And these are our truths that we've kept hidden because they are dangerous, not just for us, but for at least one other person, the one who harmed us or who failed us or who failed to believe that we mattered enough. And these others are also often not them, but still us, people we admire and trust and love. Last January, when we discovered that our beloved music director had been misconducting in our congregation, when the stories began to be told, it was confusing for many of us, even those of us who had all the details, even for me. I mean, I had all the facts, but still, it made no sense. Because it felt impossible to reconcile the good, his good, the good we've received from him, with the news of the harm. And the loss we felt with his absence and the pain we imagined him being in, that we knew he was in, losing his community and his reputation. Some wondered if it was really so bad what he did, to have to suffer that much. This is the theological question at stake in the Me Too movement. Whose suffering matters? And whose pain matters? Whose voice? I ordered the new street signs to say, "We believe women," because I know the conversation has to start with a willingness to believe women and also other marginalized people of all kinds to center their voices. But ultimately, I'm not convinced that belief has ever been the main issue. When the news broke about Harvey Weinstein, my first thought was, of course we knew this was happening. And of course people knew. The reason he didn't fall sooner wasn't because no one talked or because the ones who did weren't believed. It was because people weren't sure that these women's experiences mattered enough to upend the life and career of a powerful man. Belief is just the beginning. The bigger issue is about whose life matters enough. Whose stories? Whose suffering? This was the pressing question behind Tarana Burke's call to action back in 2007. She'd spent the prior decade to that listening to stories of sexual violence, especially among youth of color in low-wealth communities, where they were too often left without sufficient resources, including adults who had the training or capacity or power to help. Burke witnessed many young girls holding their story as if they were the only ones, and in their isolation, internalizing the blame, believing that there must be something uniquely wrong or broken about them. This despite the fact that at least 60% of Black girls will experience sexual abuse by the time they're 18. Burke believed that if they knew how many of their peers shared their story, they could release some of that internalized shame and instead believe that their lives mattered enough, that they were worthy of a better life, and gain the strength and the courage in community to fight for change. From this impulse, Burke started the Me Too movement and her organization Just Be, long before hashtags or the full explosion of social media. And also, she was a Black woman working on sexual assault and not a white Hollywood actress. And so it wasn't until last fall, about 10 years later, when Alyssa Milano tweeted out the hashtag that the call Me Too really took off. It is important, though, and Milano has recognized this in her public speech since, that at the heart of the Me Too movement is the call to hear and empower the most marginalized voices, people of color, indigenous and undocumented people, transgender and other gender nonconforming folks, to move these voices that have been the most silenced, but also who have an even greater likelihood of experiencing sexual violence, to move these to the center, to flip the cultural script, and even more importantly, the balance of power. Which is perhaps why we're starting to hear about a Me Too backlash. When those who are accustomed to having their stories and lives central to our social script are suddenly decentered so that that other stories can be heard and believed and acted upon, we often experience this shift as loss. As the saying goes, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. This brings us to the other critical theological question at stake in the Me Too movement, which is how seriously we're going to take the universalist good news that we share the same destiny, that we are all in this together, how much we mean it when we say, as Sean put it last week, that as one of us walks the plank of inherent worth, tied around our ankle is a chain that if we leap, would take us all down. Because if we mean it that when we say that our liberation is a collective pursuit, then this recentering act is about saving ourselves. It is about hearing ourselves, knowing ourselves, and ultimately healing ourselves, believing that we are worthy of healing. All of us connected together. For this reason, I take no pleasure in the idea that my male colleagues may be wondering if they are the next ones to be called out, any more than any one of us should enjoy the downfall of any of the powerful men that we've seen fall in recent months, despite their often despicable actions. The increasingly small and often toxic box for acceptable norms of masculinity and the messaging that to be a man is to be dominant or angry or aggressive, all of this so connected to the march that happened across the country yesterday. These messages and norms oppress us all and deserve their own sermon. But this is still all us. On the other hand, this same universalist faith has from its beginning rejected the doctrine of substitutionary atonement. Here's your lesson for Holy Week, which begins today. Substitutionary atonement is the idea that one innocent person's sacrifice should stand in to make up for the sins of a bunch of others. Which is to say, by our faith, we reject the idea that victims of assault and misconduct should remain silent and shamed in order to save the reputation, ego, or the employment of those who fail to take their humanity into consideration in the first place. Instead, by our faith, we believe that each of us must be accountable for our own actions, our own harm. Only that way can we restore the ties that bind each to all. We misunderstand our universalist tradition when we decide that we all go together requires an anything goes ethic. It is because we all go together that we cannot settle for cheap grace or a laissez-faire neutrality that inevitably, as Elie Wiesel said it, helps the oppressor but never the victim. As my first foray into Unitarian Universalist congregational life showed me, however, we are not historically really good at this idea of accountability. As religious liberals, we want to believe that people are good. We believe that we are good. And anything that goes against this image then becomes hard, even impossible to accept. Remember the shadow. We wouldn't do something that would violate another. We are good people. We aren't the sort that would commit sexual violence, assault, harassment, misconduct. We're good people. Nor would the people we know and love. They are good people. This singular focus on human goodness leads often to a moral fuzziness and ethical toothlessness. As we start to imagine that just because some things are a gray area, everything is gray. As if just because some things are simple mistakes made by people with good intentions, every painful action must have been done inadvertently. As if evil does not exist. But our sometimes willful and sometimes not ignorance about our own power and our desire to be a good person does not negate the real harm we are capable of enacting, and our inherent capacity to choose the good does not mean we always will. Instead, evidence seems to indicate that, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the line dividing good and evil runs not between human beings, but through us. It is possible, even regular, to be a good person and hurt someone, even terribly, even intentionally. It is possible that someone we love is lying to us, cheating us, manipulating us, abusing us. People are complex, and none of us are reducible to either our most abhorrent or our most admirable qualities. Nearly 20 years after I first discovered Unitarian Universalism, I've come to realize that built into those covenantal promises that I found so revolutionary is also an acknowledgement that we're not always going to perform perfectly as Sean reminded us last week. We're going to fall short. We're going to break faith with one another and with ourselves. But the covenantal promise is that when this happens, we'll acknowledge the harm and seek to restore relationship. If we are going to be that church that seeks and speaks the truth in love, then we need to keep growing our tolerance for truth telling and truth receiving. Most of all, I'd like to suggest by reintroducing a practice of communal confession. I know. But restorative justice cannot happen without an acknowledgement of the harm done. And confession is the religious practice that helps us deal with our shadow, helps us see and name and heal the things we cannot always see on our own. I would never wish in a million years that our country would elect a man who bragged about sexual assault. And I would never have wanted to confront sexual misconduct in our congregation in the way we did this past year. And yet these same painful experiences may have stirred up in us and in this moment a new hunger and a renewed commitment to be that church where we do this differently, where we bring our real stories, our real wounds, our confessions, and also our regrets, our confusion, and where we use these things as guideposts to map our way forward. So on this brave path that we travel together, may we remind each other that although we are not always good, we are all always worthy of love. We are all always worthy of love and healing, no exceptions. May the liberating power of this courageous universal love flow in us and inspire us and propel us forward into this liberating work for us all. Amen. Blessed be.